This is Joe Basso from Music Radar, the place for music makers, and I'm speaking with Danny Goldberg. Danny runs Gold Village Entertainment. You've also, in your time, been the PR executive for Led Zeppelin. You've managed Nirvana. You ran Atlantic Records, Mercury Records. Is there anything I'm leaving out? You've done a lot.
I'm old. Done a lot, but it's a very generous introduction.
Well, you have had an illustrious career, which you detail in your new book called Bumping Into Geniuses. Can you explain why you call the book Bumping Into Geniuses?
I can. One of my jobs was president of Atlantic Records, and the title is derived from a story about Ahmet Erdogan, who is the founder and late chairman of Atlantic Records. And it was told at his memorial service by David Geffen, one of many people who owed a big chunk of their careers to Ahmet. And when Geffen explained that when he was a young man, he was trying to figure out, he asked Ahmet, how do I get rich in the music business? And Ahmet said, the way to get rich is to wander around until you bump into a genius, and when you do, hold on and don't let go. That was a story that was frequently repeated when I was at Atlantic, not just because it's funny, but because it indicated a clarity about the role of artists in the music business, post-Beatles, post-late 60s, once artists developed the, clout that they had and still have, that they were really creating as responsible or more responsible for creating the money that was generated from music, certainly in rock and roll, than distributors were, or recording studios, or bankers, or promo people. So it was both a story about Ahmet, and it's a story about my role in the business, which is to try to do exactly what he said, to try to bump into geniuses and to try to hold on to them.
One thing I was struck by in the book is the fact that you did come up in the business at a time when there was almost no blueprint, really, for doing what you do. The book is really, in as much as you talk about the artists that you bump into, it's really about your own invention and reinvention. Did you have any idea at that time, back in the early 60s or the mid-60s, what you wanted to do?
Well, just to not make me sound older than I actually am, I got my first job at the age of 18 in late 68, so I started in the late 60s. What I wanted to do was move out of my parents' apartment and get my own place, and through an accident of fate, there was an ad in the New York Times for a clerical job at Billboard. I didn't know what Billboard was. I thought it was a magazine about signs on the highways, and only after I started working there the first week or two, I realized it was about the music business. I didn't understand that there was this whole infrastructure in between the artists that I loved and people like me. I was a kid who went to high school and graduated in the late 60s and loved the rock and roll that was going on at that time, and one of millions of kids who felt those records by Dylan and the Stones and Country Joe and the Fish and Phil Oakes and others were somehow speaking for me as well as to me. But I didn't understand that there was a business. Once I understood that people could get paid money to go to concerts and write their opinions about them, that seemed like a really good job. I could get free records, free concerts, and see my name in print. So I did everything I could to become one of the people that occasionally reviewed shows for the magazine. in the early years of my career, that's just what I wanted to do, was to be a successful rock journalist. And that was my goal and my horizon and my self-definition. And only when I realized I wasn't good enough to be a, to write for the New York Times or somebody, where that wasn't going to happen, did I start thinking about getting into the business itself. And, there were various reasons why I was not successful as a writer, but one of them was that I was too much of a fan to really have a critical eye. I just loved the people that I loved, and that's my interest in the whole thing, was being a fan, not being a critic. And over the course of time, I started to develop more of a work ethic and more ambition, but that wasn't for, I was knocking around for several years before I started to develop the goals.
Of course, one of the major bands that you came to work with, one of the early bands, was Led Zeppelin. Which leads me to ask, what are your thoughts on what's going on with them currently?
I think it's fine as long as they don't call it Led Zeppelin. To me, the idea of calling something Led Zeppelin that doesn't have Robert Plant in it is absurd. It would be equally absurd to call something Led Zeppelin that didn't have Jimmy Page in it. It's just, And John Paul Jones is pretty important too, but the lead singer is particularly important in any band. And I think for them to create some other band with another singer and call it something else will probably be interesting, depending on the quality of the work. I mean, those are very talented guys. They seem to be healthy. But to call it Led Zeppelin would be absurd, and I can't believe they'll try to do it. It would be the laughingstock of any rock and roll fan, you know. It would be like having the Rolling Stones without Mick Jagger, or, you know, Beatles without John Lennon and Paul McCartney. It's just absurd.
Have you spoken to either Jimmy or Robert recently about this?
I haven't recently. I did go to the show that they did, the reunion Led Zeppelin show in London. I guess it was about a year ago. I think it was officially a tribute to Ahmet Ertegun. It was really a celebration of Led Zeppelin, and it was a thrill to be there. It was an extraordinarily good show. Jimmy was playing particularly well, and there's no question that they can do that. And my guess is that when Robert Plant, at some point, he'll do a few more years touring with Alison Krauss. He's having this amazing success with Alison Krauss. I mean, that album may win the Album of the Year Grammy. It's certainly one of the most, it's certainly one of the best albums of the year, and I believe they're doing another one. And, you know, at some point when he's run the course of this cycle in his life, and, you know, which has got to be immensely rewarding for him to get this kind of success under his own name, my guess is that he'll pick up the phone and call Jimmy Page, and they'll do some billion-dollar Led Zeppelin tour. But it would be insane for these other guys to call something they do Led Zeppelin. It's not at all insane for them to work together and make music under another name. But no, I haven't. You know, when I've run into them over the years, it's been very nice. But you know, I haven't worked with them professionally in many years, and they're not like social friends of mine. So I have not spoken to them in the last few years.
One gets the feeling, however, that Robert is almost past Led Zeppelin now. At least some of the things he's saying, if you look between the lines, do you think that's true?
I think he's very proud of being successful without Led Zeppelin. Very few people are in big bands who have this kind of success on their own, and I think he wants to keep the focus on that. But that doesn't mean that for the rest of his life he's not going to want to do something with Led Zeppelin. It means right now he doesn't want to do it.
One of the other stories, of course, that's current in the music news is Guns N' Roses. If you were managing Axl Rose during these past few years, how would you have advised him to handle things differently?
First of all, I don't know Axl Rose. So, you know, until you know an artist, you don't really know. You don't know the nuances of what they can and can't do and what they're comfortable doing. You know, probably it would have been better if he didn't wait so long to put out a record, because you know, because the level of expectation, you know, became very difficult for anybody to live up to. But I wouldn't presume to criticize the way someone else managed an artist. That's, I wouldn't want anyone doing that to me.
Like Cameron Crowe, you were one of the first rock writers to get Led Zeppelin. Why do you think that was? Why did so many?
Well, I got them. I know why I got them. I got them because it was my job. You know, because I was able to, because I was working for a PR firm and they became a client. So I was lucky to be in that position. And only after seeing them live a few times did I really understand how good they were artistically, because I was of that generation. You know, I was 22, 23, and I was 6 or 7 years older than 15 or 16-year-olds who were their core audience for Zeppelin. I think the reason that the critics didn't get them was that the critics were my age or a year or two older, and, you know, had that generational myopia that's so common, where people just think the music of the next generation is not as good as their favorites. Why Cameron got them is he was younger. You know, I mean, that's why Bob Hilburn, when I did my book, I asked him about, you know, that's precisely why he assigned Cameron to interview Zeppelin when Cameron was 15 or 16, because he recognized that he didn't understand this, and that yet there was a big audience for it, and that he needed the eyes of somebody of the generation of their audience to write about it. So that's the brilliance of Bob Hilburn as an editor, and I think that was one of Cameron's first assignments. It was certainly his highest profile assignment at that time. But, you know, the rock critical culture had come around, you know, 67-ish when Crawdaddy, 66, 67, when Crawdaddy started. I think Crawdaddy started in 66, 67, Rolling Stone starts around that same time. There are people at the dailies and magazines starting to write about rock and roll because it's becoming a bigger part of the culture. And they embraced artists like Dylan and the Jefferson Airplane and the Doors and the Stones, of course, as well as the Beatles, obviously, had come a little earlier. And they were really, you know, Hendrix, and you know, they were both generationally connected with what was big then, and they were also important in a way that they would not be a few years later, because by '69, when Led Zeppelin's first album came out, rock radio, what was then called underground radio, had exploded across the North American continent, and suddenly it wasn't 30 or 40 critics that were defining an artist; it was you know, putting them on the map. It was these stations playing Led Zeppelin. After a week, they were like big. So I think, in addition to being generationally removed from the core audience for Zeppelin, I think a lot of the critics were kind of jealous that their power had been diminished and that rock radio had supplanted them as the number one gatekeepers to the rock audience. But, you know, I'm just theorizing about this. I can't prove it.